This is Angle of View. Today is March 31st, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. The number one movie in the United States right now is Project Hail Mary, starring Ryan Gosling. Written for the screen and directed by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, the Spider-Verse guys, from a novel by Andy Weir, the Martian guy. In keeping with a hot trend for 2026, it is one of the worst movies I have ever seen. Here, in its entirety, is my review of Project Hail Mary. Hot nerd comedian and his talking dog fight for their survival against an editor who hates movies. A heroic adventure for the sludge content generation. That's it. I didn't have it in me to write more than that, and nobody can make me. I don't mind telling you that I'm in crisis over here. I like to use despair as a verb. It has a pleasing 19th century heft. Here's an example sentence. I despair. I despair of movies at this time. That's how you connect the verb to an object. I don't know how I can have a future writing and talking about them unless the state of the art gets way better way fast, and that's not a bet I would take, following roughly 20 years of steady movement in the opposite direction. I suppose you could argue that this long, excruciating decline means we must be due for one of those ruptures that the culture relies upon periodically for its renewal. But I would say we're actually comically long overdue for one of those. In fact, we're dying without it, and we're still not getting it. So maybe we're not going to get it. It might actually be that capitalistic sclerosis and algorithm supremacy have thrown the relationship between art and media into an imbalance so severe and entrenched that we won't be able to right it until after our economic system perishes. In that case, it would absolutely mean that for all intents and purposes, and as far as our lifespans are concerned, the medium of motion pictures is sliding away. I also realize that my laments of this sort were never entertaining in the first place, and are now getting old to boot. I've gone from offering fresh lemons to wrinkly, moldy ones. Oh, crap. I'm in decline. It's infectious. Now kindly pretend that I've spoke some witty segue and transitioned gorgeously into the main material of this week's show, which is capsule reviews of movies I've seen in the past 2 to 3 months but not spoken about on the air, not all of which are among the worst movies I've ever seen. Song Sung Blue, directed by Craig Brewer. The one about the husband and wife Neil Diamond tribute act, which is based on a true story, though this does nothing to save the movie from being a 10-ton slab of baloney. The multiple crises are overcooked until gray, with dreadfully repetitious rhythms. The many reveals, both comic and tragic, are quintessential hack stuff. The younger kid, the boy, has literally no personality outside of being a cheerleader for his parents. Hugh Jackman continues to condescend to his characters. Jim Belushi is doing way too much. Fisher Stevens has completed his transformation into Quagmire from Family Guy. The musical performance scenes are the only ones that Brewer directs passably. Kate Hudson is brilliant, though. She inhabits the character of Claire so completely that she makes Jackman's shallowness all the more perceptible. One of Them Days, directed by Lawrence Lamont. A race against time stress comedy starring Kiki Palmer and SZA as bestie roommates given until the end of the day to replace their vanished rent money. A lot of the plot is formulaic, and some of the composed jokes are obvious or old hat, but my God, do I love these two leads. Sparks shoot out of the frame when they're in it together, which thankfully is almost the whole time. Roof Man, directed by Derek Cianfrance. Another true story, this one about a guy who started breaking into McDonald's in the late 90s to rob them, and was given the titular name by the media for his preferred mode of entrance. This kind of criminal family man double life movie has been done 100 times, and the refreshingly sharp edges that set it apart from the pack near the beginning, the acid humor about his military training making him a better criminal, the boy adventurer quality of his crimes that set him up perfectly to live inside a toy store, are methodically filed down over the substantial running time, to the point where there isn't really any spark left firing in it by the end, and it's become just another drama about the meaning of family and the importance of family for giving meaning to life. It's very well cast, and every performer is committed and thoughtful, but the best stuff is Channing Tatum alone inside a Toys R Us at night, fully living the boy adventurer life, improvising improvements in his habitation and goofing around, And despite the fact that these are the scenes which cement Tatum as the perfect choice of lead actor, a movie that's primarily about personal attachments shouldn't derive most of its charm from scenes where the protagonist is alone. Footnote, it bugs me that Lee, Kirsten Dunst, the love interest, isn't a richer character. And the clearest evidence of this is that she's not adequately suspicious of her beau, with his mysterious secret government job that he is very bad at dissembling about, and the enormous amount of money that he seems to have access to. I can see her being swept off her feet by the guy and too smitten to want to think about it over their first few weeks together, but they are a couple for what looks like the better part of a year, judging by the holidays that pass, and at no point is there any suggestion that she suspects anything amiss, nor that she had reasons for refusing to take the closer look at him that would arouse her suspicion. In a work of pure fiction, the writer would hopefully deal with this by, for example, insinuating something about this church-going single mom secretly and shamefully getting off on the idea of the hunky new guy in her life being an outlaw. But here, presumably because there is a real Lee, and that's even her real name, the writing team didn't want to go making those kinds of implications about her character. This is a great negative example of the benefit of taking dramatic liberties. Sirat, directed by Oliver Lasha. This is the one about the guy in his 50s who wanders among desert raves in northern Africa with his young son to look for his daughter who went missing after a desert rave in northern Africa. It's not so much a drama as just a wash of horrors that turn ever more abstract and symbolic. Seems like something you might see on the stage, if only you could blow up trucks there. It's unfortunate that it has so little interest in people. Pillion, directed by Harry Lytton. What heart beats beneath BDSM dynamics? Certainly there can't be just one type of BDSM relationship, any more than there can be just one type of relationship. But is it possible that the terms of BDSM might make relationship dysfunction harder to spot, and harder still to repair? Is a person used to being a doormat in life likelier to get off on being a sexual submissive? Does that charge the arrangement with neurosis? Can kinks exist without any accompanying neurosis? How could the healthy and unhealthy psychological aspects of such a situation ever hope to be disentangled after getting sex mixed up in things? And what about when you're not having sex? If the veil of the performance is never lifted inside a BDSM relationship, then what is the relationship? Can there even be said to be one if vulnerability is forsworn and need is designated a one-way street? What becomes of the deeper emotional needs of the submissive? If they are not feeling gratified in their role as submissive, how are they supposed to come to a realization of this, let alone be able to articulate it? If they want the relationship to change, how are they to negotiate this when the whole founding idea is that nothing is negotiated because the arrangement has a master and a servant? How can the two be equals when the whole agreement is that they're not? How do you know if the BDSM relationship you're in is good or bad for you? It is to Pillion's immense credit that it avidly deals with all of these questions. This is a story that requires a really delicate hand to keep from collapsing into a stream of cheap punchlines about the central kink and all its trappings. And the film's writer-director, 32-year-old first-timer Harry Lytton, instead pushes you under the stream so you can feel the forces driving this arrangement from the inside. Lytton has not just a patience and a nimble subtlety beyond his years, but a warm and abiding curiosity. And this, above all, is what keeps Pillion not just lively, but deep, sweet, sad, and honest. I haven't read the novel it's based on, Box Hill by Adam Mars Jones. But the screen drama here is strong in ways that call good short fiction to mind. Sparse cutting dialogue, heavy silences, a sense of people going through real transformation. Not just the primary one, but all the interpersonal tensions in the film are carefully coaxed forth and tended like slow fires. Every scene alters the shape of everything, at least a little. It's got a sound dramatic structure, which might well come from Mars Jones's novel, and marvelous career-best lead performances from Harry Melling and Alexander Skarsgård, but Lytton is the tender force, holding it all together and making it sing. Send Help, directed by Sam Raimi. The one about the overworked and under-recognized professional woman, Rachel McAdams, who gets stuck on a desert island with her bro-y douchebag of a boss, Dylan O'Brien. It's a fun horror slapstick romp, from one of the greatest ever to do that particular thing, right up until a heartbreakingly bad third act in which the grain of moral corruption in the main character, which had previously been an alluring kind of seasoning, rises up to swallow her completely, and everything that had been fun in the plot is impaled on a dumbass reveal, and the two badnesses feed on each other, so that it gets uglier and dumber and uglier and dumber every 30 seconds. Castration Movie Anthology 1, Traps, directed by Louise Weird. Utterly Vital, a 10-dimensionally fearless, splattered mess, a cringe comedy that's also a literary epic, and one of the rare movies that totally transfigures its too-muchness into its chief virtue, itself a literary kind of feat. It is incredible what an open and non-judgmental film it is. Nobody is protected or punished by the film, so everything is the character's responsibilities, and so when they hurt and fail each other, it feels sickening, like someone could die from it, and when they show each other kindness and support, it's like they're handing out oxygen. It's incredible that Weird would allow herself to play someone not just wounded and angry, but cruel, and that she would have the dramatic strength to make the conception of the character so expansive that all those adjectives become cheap and instant after you've thought them. The title is brilliant. It's a punk provocation on sight that also sets up the bigger provocation, the parallel between the incel narrative and the trans narrative, and it speaks these crises in the most hostile possible terms, because that is usually how people in pain talk to themselves. Magellan, directed by Lav Diaz. The deliberateness of Diaz, the great slow cinema master of the Philippines, serves both stories of colonial conquest and stories of three-year maritime journeys very well, because both ventures produce corpses in huge quantities, and there is nauseous poetry in being made to stay with those corpses, right on top of them, reckoning with what they used to be and no longer are for long periods of time. This is the real burden of the colonialist, the certainty of and dependency on bloodshed, the psychic weight of which is felt here by this refusal to turn away. Diaz frequently puts a dead face or a silent sufferer to one side of the foreground as a conversation among the living plays out farther back in the frame, and the pristine depth of field forces your brain to integrate the horror with the mundanities of its oversight. As a matter of fact, all of Diaz's compositions are splendid, and without being showy. They all have dramatic rather than purely aesthetic intention and bring Dreyer to mind, nearly as often as the more obvious reference, Rivette, Tar, Martel, Hong, Viracetacul. But too much of the drama, as written, feels bizarrely, incredibly, overcompressed and simplified, so that in scenes of exposition or plot development, and actually in most scenes that steer away from the central oppressive violence and its consequent rot and wretchedness, the long static takes feel too airy. There are some other successes produced by this unbelievably patient camera, like an early shot of drifting down a slow river at the speed of a raft, and the way the practice common to every character's religion, begging for mercy, rings out in the silences, and the first scene between Magellan and his wife Beatrice, in which the touch she gives in a nursing capacity is misinterpreted by some very old loneliness inside him, and she sprints in shame. But the scenes with more focused outcomes are just too neat, and in a way that too closely calls more conventional Hollywood historical epics to mind. Magellan coming to blows with Francisco before he goes off to ply the Spanish crown, for example. Or the sequence in which he goes to medicate a Cebuano child who for some reason has scurvy, as though it were communicable, just feel too narratively ordinary and emotionally shallow to merit the 6-minute linger. It is also a shame that even a movie this spare and laconic felt powerless during its scene revealing Beatrice's pregnancy to resist the cliché of the father putting his hand on the mother's belly as she says, "He's kicking." Contrast these with, for instance, the riveting sequence of the Cebuana women pushing their bundled dead out to sea, and it becomes clear that the content is what validates the approach, and it does so inconsistently. The final sequence of Magellan's remains is another masterful moment, and it's senselessly followed by some of the most pointless and ruinous voiceover I can remember. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.